Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Greenwich Streets. I'm Russell Pruner here along with my co-host Mark Pruner. We're both realtors here in Greenwich and working at Compass Real Estate. We bring you each week the best of our hometown and what it has to offer, and you know, really talk about our profession and what's going on in the Greenwich real estate market here. Mark, how you doing?
I am doing well. It was a good weekend. Enjoyed it and got out to see some open houses that I didn't get to see because we were doing open houses. So some of the sites were busy, some not so much, which is very much like our market is.
Yeah, no, it is. I was out over the weekend just driving around. I drove over to the listing Bill Anders has over on 20 Blind Brook, and it looked like a revolving door. On for just under $1.3 million, and got a lot of activity in, from what I understand, is going to go to multiple offers maybe Tuesday. So, you know, the market is still active for those new listings well-priced out there, and, you know, I think we're going to have a continued market similar to last year. What do you think?
Yeah, well, and, you know, and that's the interesting thing. Our inventory has varied between 138 and 140. I mean, exactly flat for the past 3 weeks. At the same time, the number of contracts has gone from 52 contracts to 74 contracts. So 12 properties went to contract, and those are the same 12 properties, and in some cases, that had just come on. So the market is very hot for stuff that comes on that doesn't need a lot of work. If you need work, the one thing that the increase in the interest rates have done is made buyers take a second look. So yeah, good stuff sells really quickly. So you got to move quickly. If you're looking to do a deal, now is the perfect time for those people that have stayed over the winter and have accumulated days on market. And so they're thinking, I'm getting the new inventories coming on. Do I really want to compete against that? So relook at some of the stuff that you may not have thought had been perfect. Factor in what you're going to spend for the first year and look at your first year cost, and you may have a really good deal.
Yeah, Mark, I think we're going to see a market that's very similar to what we've seen in the spring market of 2022, where there's going to be a lot of houses that might not get counted in our inventory numbers. We can see by the number of contracts going up that, you know, clearly houses are coming on the market. Demand is still very high by buyers. And I think that they understand now, given the interest rates and where they are, what they can't afford. And I think that demand is, back in the market, ready to buy.
Yep. But let's get to the exciting part here. We have Mike Jones here, partner at Ivy Barnum O'Mara, one of the great guys and an excellent attorney who does a lot of good real estate work, particularly at the high end. I'll let Mike tell you a little bit about himself and a little bit about Ivy Barnum, the oldest law firm here in town.
Sure. Hi, Russ and Mark. Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, I got out of law school in 1983, so this is the 40th year of me practicing law. I don't know if I should be happy or sad about that, but my practice consists mainly of doing litigation and real estate. It's about an even balance between the two. And to follow up on what you said, Mark, the firm Ivy Barnum & O'Mara, which is located at 170 Mason Street here in Greenwich, has been in existence now for almost 75 years, and it's a pretty rare thing in the law business these days to have a law firm that has not merged with a big New York or Hartford firm to still have the same name. We're pretty proud of the fact that we're basically an institution in Greenwich. And right now we have, I think we're also the largest firm in Greenwich. We have close to 30 lawyers. We also have a new Canaan office that's staffed by 3 lawyers. So we've got a pretty thriving practice. We've managed to survive COVID. And that's in good part to the fact that the real estate market has been so strong with as we've seen, the escape from New York with everybody coming out due to COVID and also crime issues and assorted other issues. So we've had a couple of strong selling seasons. And I think you guys are right. I think this season, although we didn't think so a couple months ago, I think this season is starting to shape up similar to the ones that we've had the last 2 years. Just in the past 2 weeks, we've seen 20 contracts come into the office.
Yeah, no, it really is amazing in our market that while other towns have seen major drops in prices, our prices are still going up, though our sales are going down. And the only reason sales are going down is we just don't have anything to sell them. So if you got a listing, call either Mark or call me or Russ and put it on, so and we'll get it sold for you. But anyway, let's talk a little bit, Mike, about how you're found as an attorney. I mean, and when people are in the business, how do they find you and kind of what's the first steps when you meet with somebody?
Yeah, sure. I think most of our business comes from broker referrals. I think that the lawyers in our office that do real estate closings have a pretty good network within the brokerage community. We all have, we've spent a lot of years out to dinner and out to lunch and also just doing a good job.
Well, the Ivy Barnum Christmas party is the event in the real estate industry every December.
Yeah. We usually kick off the season. I think this year we're actually going to try to do it in the spring, because it's the market once again is going to be strong and we know that the realtors really look forward to coming to right to our office, which it's pretty tough because we usually get 150 to 200 people and trying to fit them all into the reception area.
It's a cozy reception.
Yeah, cozy.
And they have great handouts. My business cards are in a little Ivy Barnum or business card holder on my desk.
We know who to take care of, Mark. So that usually kicks off the season. And generally, the referrals come, sometimes it comes through word of mouth, other, satisfied clients. It comes through just connections that you have, either friends or family. And as I say, I think for the most part, it comes from the realtor community.
Yeah. And then when you meet the people, what do you talk about and retainer agreements and how's that process work?
Yeah, so the retainer agreement has become more and more important. Particularly, it protects both the attorney and the client. From the attorney's side, it's important in a real estate deal to have a written understanding of what you're going to provide to the client. And the protection for the lawyer is that a lot of times you'll get down the road pretty far on a deal and then the deal craters. And when and you may have already spent, 10, 20, 30 hours working on the deal. And a lot of times clients think, well, okay, I'll just, when I go to the next house, you'll be my lawyer, so I'll take care of you then. And that's not really, after you spent a good 25 or 30 hours working on a deal, you'd like to get something for your time. So usually there's now a provision in the retainer agreement that deals with that situation. From the client side, it's all about disclosure and transparency. You want to know exactly how the lawyer is charging you, whether it's going to be a flat fee or an hourly rate. And know exactly what you're going to get into.
So now I've got to accept.
Yeah,
okay, ahead, Garris.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, we've worked together a number of times, and I think the thing that people need to understand is that the realtor basically negotiates the deal and then prepares what we call an offer to purchase, which is just a factual document that is non-binding on the buyer and seller. And basically contains the basics of the deal with the closing, the price, where there's financing contingencies, inspections, inclusions, exclusions, and all of that. And then, once we get that agreed to between the buyer and the seller, then what we normally do, we'll give it to attorney like Mike. And, Mike, what do you do with the offer to purchase once you receive it?
Yeah, so if we're on the sales, representing the seller, as soon as we get the offer to purchase, we start to prepare the contract. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is that we usually have about a 24-hour turnaround. If we get the term sheet in, we can usually have the contract out by the next day. If you're on the buy side, you're waiting for the seller's attorney to deliver the contract to you, and then once you get it, you start to make your changes to it and usually add a buyer's rider, which builds in additional protections for the buyer client.
Yeah, and that 24-hour turnaround time is a big plus, because if you've got a deal, you want to maintain the momentum of that deal. If it's going to be 3 or 4 days before they get the contract, you can be sure the buyer is going to continue to be looking at the new listings that are coming on. So, yeah, on the seller side, it's important. So what kind of contract do you use?
We use the standard Fairfield County Bar contract, which is something that every couple of years a good group of the attorneys that are doing closings in town will get together, and we'll try if there's things that we're starting to see where some of the language isn't working or some of the language needs to be amplified or edited. We'll make some suggestions and put some new provisions either into the contract itself or into the buyer's rider, depending again on which side that you're on, and try to just constantly make the thing sort of a living document where it continues to be improved and fits the market as it continues to evolve.
Hey, Mike, what about in the case of somebody coming forward and all of that and engaging you or as either on the buy side or the sell side, how important is it to have somebody else that's familiar with the Greenwich Bar Association contract?
Yeah, that's a good question, Russ. There's always a sigh of relief when you see that there's a Greenwich lawyer on the other side. All too often, if a client's coming out of New York City, they want to work with their New York lawyer, who sometimes is even admitted in Connecticut. And that always amazes me that the lawyers still take it on because it's the unauthorized practice of law in another state. But but if they are admitted in Connecticut, they're generally not doing Connecticut deals. And then. A lot of times and you see this often with the New York City lawyers, they'll over lawyer it and they'll start trying to negotiate, half of the Fairfield County bar contract. And the process starts to bog down. And as Mark was referring to, things need to move quickly in this market because there's usually another buyer out there, particularly for a good house, that's just chomping at the bit to be the next offer accepted and move forward. So we really like to see that we're dealing with local attorneys. For the most part, within town, we know all the lawyers, so that just and we know that how they work, so that helps as well, particularly when it comes to even changes that are going to be made to the contract. When you've worked with, someone that's been in town that you've dealt, you've done 20, 30, 40 deals with on the other side, you have a good sense for what their contract looks like and what rider changes they want to make and that type of thing.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about the Fairfield County Bar Association form is it's designed to be a balanced form, so not pro buyer or pro seller. Each attorney has their own rider they put on. What things do you see as kind of points of contention or are they get negotiated the most between the seller's rider and the buyer's rider?
Well, the seller's rider tends to be more about it. It's more of a disclosure with respect to environment, places that a buyer can go to look up things that affect the environment, whether it be lead paint, oil tanks, or even where the town refuse center is.
So yeah, there's not hunting and shooting.
I saw that one too. Yeah, to be honest, we don't really pay too much attention on either side to the seller's rider. I think the most important paragraph in there is the fact that anything other than the closing date is time is of the essence. But with respect to the buyer's rider is more to us is more important. Certainly from both sides because the buyer. It within town, most of the lawyers will attach a buyer's rider that contains about 20 paragraphs. And some of them are pretty standard things. There's a couple of sort of amusing ones. There's one that's based on a statute, this is very interesting. It came in back in the days where HIV and AIDS were pretty prevalent. And the idea, it was basically a full disclosure with respect to things that are sort of outside the ordinary. And it was considered that if someone had AIDS in that house, that was supposed to be disclosed. I mean, fortunately, we've gotten away from that and things have improved in that area.
And how about paranormal experiences?
Well, that's where I was going next. When I explain it to my clients, I call it the ghost paragraph because it's one of those things where if a house is haunted or more likely, not that it happens often, but if someone has been murdered in the house or committed suicide or even just passed away in the house, a lot of times buyers want to know that because they don't want to know if there's
we've got several cultures where that's a very big issue.
I actually personally lost a deal once because my house was next to a cemetery. So, but it was in one of those small Indian cemeteries that dated back, to the 1600s, and the lady just kind of freaked out and all of a sudden didn't want to buy the house.
Same with me.
the buyer's rider is important, and there's a couple of really important paragraphs in there. One deals with the oil tank situation, which is generally something that you have to pay attention to. And
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So you've got the oil tank situation, which these days, for the most part, sellers understand that if they got an issue with an oil tank, they have to take care of it because the next buyer is going to make them do that anyway. And then the other important one, two more important ones, which are sort of related, is that with respect to water intrusion, that's always a big deal here in Greenwich because we've had, we had Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Ida and houses that never get water. When the hurricanes come, you always see some houses that get flooded in the basement. And that has to be disclosed. And one of the ways – and sometimes clients don't want to disclose it, and you have to give them the proper advice on that. But also there's a paragraph that now we've put in more recently that talks about insurance claims, because that's how you smoke out whether or not somebody's had damage to the basement and gotten it fixed through insurance. So you ask them to the seller to disclose that whether or not they've put an insurance claim in, and you will find that out when the buyer goes to get insurance, because the insurance companies share that information.
Oh yeah, they're very good about that. So that's the contracting process. We're going to come back and just talk about all of the issues with the mortgage process and the infinite number of forms that banks send out. So we'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Rand Insurance has been part of the Greenwich community since 1938, and we're located next to the J House in Riverside. We've been helping successful individuals, families, and local businesses with their insurance needs for over 80 years. Contact the Rand experts for insurance for your home, cars, and business, as well as cyber insurance and coverage for your jewelry, wine collection, and vintage cars. Get in touch with us at 203-637-1006 or at randinsurance.com. Experience the Rand difference.
Hi, I'm Tony Savino. Join me Thursday mornings at 9 o'clock for Spotlight on Medicine. Each week I speak with the doctors, nurses, and medical experts at Greenwich Hospital. This week on Spotlight, an update on the Smilo Cancer Hospital Care Center in Stamford. My guests are oncology nurse navigator Lynn Carbino and clinical program manager, registered nurse Irene Piazza. That's Spotlight on Medicine Thursday mornings at 9 on 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Greenwich Streets. With us today is Mike Jones. He's a local attorney. Been practicing, I hate to say it, Mike, for 40 years, but tremendous experience and all that. We've been talking a little bit about the attorney's role in the real estate transaction. Mike, let's talk for a second about sort of the mortgage process and sort of how that what role does an attorney take in that process?
Yeah, so and first, so you've got the contract everybody has agreed to. What about house signing and the exchange of the initial down payment done? And then how do you work with the banks on the mortgages?
Okay, so with respect to the signing, once the contract's fully negotiated, this, as I said earlier, the seller prepares the contract, delivers to the buyer's attorney, gets fully negotiated. The buyer then delivers the buyer's attorney delivers the contract back signed with the 10% deposit. Seller's attorney holds the 10% deposit until closing. And then at that point, that's when the bank part of it starts. It's interesting because in Greenwich nowadays, there's so many deals that are cash and that you don't even have the banks involved. But for the ones where there is a mortgage contingency, then you have to wait. The seller has to wait as the buyer starts to go down the road of applying for the mortgage, getting the mortgage approved. There'll be an appraisal. And then usually the mortgage contingencies, usually it takes about 30 to 45 days to get the mortgage. So the seller sort of has to wait while that's a contingency in the contract. But once the mortgage is approved and the buyer gets a commitment letter, then you can schedule the closing and start to get ready to do what needs to be done to get the deal done.
Yeah, and what sort of things, what's your interaction with the bank as that process is going on?
Well, we don't really have to do too – usually the client handles the day-to-day in terms of applying for the mortgage and working through what the bank needs, because a lot of it's personal financial information that they're supplying to the bank. And certainly there's the appraisals part of it, which, again, the realtors have to get the appraiser into the house and get that done. But so we don't have too much to do, thankfully, other than make sure that you sort of talk to the client about moving the process along, because the sooner they can get they can clear the mortgage contingency, the quicker we can set up the closing.
So once the bank gives you an approval, and then why? Because sometimes an approval isn't quite an approval. They usually come back with a long list of conditions, some of which seem to be acceptable, some of which don't really mean the contingency can be removed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So sometimes, like you said, sometimes the banks come back with conditions. The conditions, a good amount of the time, the conditions will relate to the client's financial circumstances. They may want some sort of letter from the employer of the purchaser. We don't usually get too involved in the condition aspect of it, unless it deals with the house itself. And where you'll see that sometimes is with repairs. If there's certain repairs that need to be made, and somehow the bank has become, maybe through the appraisal, the bank finds out that there's things that need to be repaired. The bank may come back and say, you know, we're not going to let you close, and we're not going to fund until certain repairs are made. Or, which gets into another whole topic, if there's open building permits on the property and they have to be closed out before the bank's willing to put the financing up.
Yes. What about this? Because we constantly hear about the open building permits, and then the other one is unpermitted work. You know, I one time had a buyer who went to the house, and it turned out the seller had put an entire wing on the house without any permits at all.
Yeah, we had one recently where the seller had finished the basement and didn't pull any permits to do all the plumbing and electrical work. And the town decided that they were not going to be easy on it, and they went in and they forced the seller, before we could close, the seller had to go in, basically start ripping the sheetrock off the walls, show that the wiring was proper, show that the plumbing was proper, and then had to repair all of it before we could close and that the buyer could take the house. And it ended up costing the seller, I think, between $30,000 and $40,000.
Yeah, because one of the things we see frequently is a contractor will come in, pull the permits, do the proper work, but then he's on to another project, and he doesn't end up closing out the building permit. What happens then?
Yeah, so there's a couple that brings up some interesting scenarios. Usually, and that's why we do what's called a municipal search on the property, and we check to see whether or not there are open permits. And usually it's for electrical or plumbing, those types of things. But what happens is if the permit was pulled, there's a statute that says that if the permit's been pulled more than 9 years ago, it's closed by operation of law. The town won't even get involved, and you can still close without any sort of problem. If the permits were pulled less than 9 years, then you've got an issue because you've got to usually have to hire a contractor to go back and finish whatever needs to be finished. And a lot of times it's just getting this sign off on a final inspection because the work's been done. It's just a question of getting the work inspected and making sure that it was done properly. So that usually means just getting someone in from the town to do the final inspection. They close it out with a CO, and then we can close.
Yeah, that's one of the great things.
It's funny you mentioned that. I've got one I'm working on right now that most people don't know, you have to take out a tent permit if you have a tent in your backyard for a party or a wedding or something like that. And so one of the conditions of closing is that I've got to get the town to come out and just get them on the property to show them that the tent is no longer there,
right,
although it was taken away the day after.
Right.
I had one of those, and they never even put the tent up because it was very stormy that the wind and rain would have blown right under the tent. So yeah, it's funny. I tried to send them a photo and said, "No, we'll drive by and make sure there's no tent."
One of the things that we recommend, certainly to sellers, is when you put your house on the market, and we usually recommend that this. I did a seminar for the Grand Association of Realtors just this past Friday morning, and one of the things that I recommended to them is that right when a client is ready to list a property, it's a good idea, especially if you know who the client's attorney is already going to be, have that attorney do what's called a seller's rundown at town hall and check things like this. See if there's open permits. And the seller can get going on closing those permits out before they even have a buyer. So that streamlines the process once you get to the point where you've got an offer and you've got the contracts being prepared and people are ready to sign. You've already got somebody working on getting the permits closed out.
Yeah, one of the things there is not only do you have permits, but you got in a dispute with the contractor and you paid him less than he thought was done, and there may be a lien on the property.
Yeah, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. Then the seller's got issues. They've got to go in and they've either got to negotiate with the lienor to get the lien off the property. Or if depending on the size of the lien and what's involved, they can escrow enough money to cover the lien and the attorney's fees that are associated with the lien. Sometimes the title insurance company for the buyer will still allow the buyer to purchase, and they'll insure over the lien. In order to do that, everyone involved has to know what sort of the universe is with respect to the claim on the lien. Because, I had one where the lien was $1 million. There was no way that people were going to be able to close. And we ended up having to move. That was where I put my litigation hat on. We went to court and got the lien discharged and had to get a court to order that to happen. So, you know, that when you start getting in that situation, it can go a lot of different ways. And unfortunately, sometimes really go sideways.
Yeah.
So.
Let's talk about the different types of liens, and do they really affect you from the legal process? Because as somebody once told me that all deals are all cash deals at closing, because the money either comes from the buyer or it comes from the buyer's mortgage company. Does it really matter from a legal viewpoint whether it's a 30-year fixed or a 7-year ARM or something like that?
In terms of the mortgage versus lien?
In terms of your work as a lawyer.
So different type. I guess let's back it up. We'll go to different types of liens. We've already touched on the mechanics lien, where someone's done work on the house and they put a lien against it because they didn't get paid. You've also got judgment liens. I mean, we've all had situations where a seller unfortunately has gotten, you know, nose over the skis in terms of their credit and people that they owe money to. So someone has gone ahead and brought an action against them and gotten a judgment lien. Judgment liens actually can be sometimes the easiest ones to deal with because the money to pay off the judgment can come from the proceeds of the sale. So that it's actually a little bit easier to deal with sometimes than a mechanics lien. With respect to the types of mortgages that people get, you know, certainly there's adjustable rate mortgages, there's fixed rate mortgages. When we go to close where someone has a mortgage lien, we just have to make sure you don't want to get this is also the caution to the buyers. When you go to buy a house, if the person's got numerous mortgages and it looks like there's very little equity in the house, you have to just be aware, and the purchasing attorney has to be aware that they've got to make sure that there's enough funds there to actually do the closing and make sure that those mortgage liens can be paid off.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, Russ.
Quick question on that. When you are doing, because normally at closing, most people, although they might go all cash, might still have a mortgage on the property. When you do that, does the bank send their own attorney to close that, or are you representing the bank as their attorney?
No, we still – so seller's attorney will sign indemnity letters. And, you know, it's funny. Just historically, unfortunately, there have been issues where attorneys – and this happens more than you would like – to hear about where attorneys actually steal the mortgage money, you know, and there's a whole variety of ways that they've done it. And it's interesting because for the most part in Connecticut, and I hate to say this, but it's been sole practitioners in the Naugatuck Valley. There's something about the water up there. But a lot of the cases that we've seen where lawyers are taking the mortgage money and using it for personal use, it comes from sort of mid-state in Connecticut. But the point is that you've got to be real. The selling attorney is responsible to make sure that the checks go to the mortgage companies, but the buyer's attorneys. The change that came in is that the buyer's attorneys will actually make the checks out to the lender, to the mortgage company, and that this way there's no issues. You're not just giving the settlement funds are not just one check to the seller's lawyer.
Actually, talk a little bit about the mortgage and the loan, because they're two different documents.
Yeah.
And I think most people say, I'm getting a mortgage.
Yeah.
And if they're getting a mortgage, all they're getting is a lien and no money.
Yeah, what people don't realize, it's very interesting. I even have to sort of give a little primer sometimes to our young associates that come in and just sort of explain. When you apply for a mortgage and you go to sit down at the closing, the documents that you're going to sign, one of the first documents you're going to sign is the promissory note. That's the promise to pay back the money that you're being loaned. The mortgage is actually a document that gets recorded on the land records against the house that you're buying, so that it shows that the bank usually has a first interest in the first position, first lien, priority lien against the house, and that secures the promissory note that you've signed, your promise to pay back. So the note is the promise and the mortgage is the lien. And that's something a lot of people don't understand, but they'll always talk about, well, I gave them a mortgage. Well, what that means is you gave them basically a lien against your house to secure the debt that you've incurred to the bank.
So that's a simple process. The bank only wants you to sign two instruments and you're all done. Is that it?
No. Usually the bank documents are about the thickness of a phone book. Some banks are good. Some banks have streamlined the process there's less paper. But it's funny, in this computerized world, I think there's more paperwork now with mortgages than there ever has been. But that's because there's a lot of other types of documents that you sign, which are basically a lot of disclosures about whether or not you're going to live in the house, and the reason they ask for that is because if you don't, if it's investment property, they would charge you a higher rate of interest. There used to be a document that said that you literally would sign this document. It said, I am not a terrorist. This was after 9/11. Well, a terrorist isn't necessarily going to admit that. So, you know, sort of an interesting document.
My favorite one when I was doing real estate closings back when I was a real estate attorney was there was a document. You got like 18 documents, and the 18th one was a document that said that you are really who you say you are and that this is your signature. And I was just thinking, so the guy signed, lied on the previous 17 documents, but this one's going to catch him up.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I've actually had a couple of situations. I had one situation where we had a Russian buyer came in, and I'm not trying to I'll leave the Russian part out of it. Russian buyer comes in and brings this woman in. The woman doesn't look anything like the driver's license for his wife. And it turned out that it wasn't his wife. Right. So, and you have to vet all this out at the closing. So even though and that's one out of maybe 1,000 closings that I've done. But the fact of the matter is sometimes you get somebody that's sort of trying to pull a fast one.
Yeah.
And you have to watch out for that.
Well,
I always loved the document that you have to sign that says if anything is wrong, that you've got to come back to the table or get signed again, another document, because the bank finds something that wasn't correct in the document or something.
Well,
like that.
You know where that comes from. Okay, so back in the probably, I think in the 80s or 90s, when we had one of our financial downturns, there was an enterprising lawyer here in Greenwich, who I will not name on the show, but he came up with a defense to mortgage foreclosures that basically said my client didn't sign the 13th page of the mortgage, therefore the mortgage is invalid. And all it was an attempt to delay the mortgage process. And the document you're talking about, Russ, was a direct offshoot from those defenses that were raised back then.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So one question is, so you've got the mortgage and you had mentioned about the identity thing. How do you decide what type of title you're going to take? Should you do it in your own name? Should you do it as joint tenants with right of survivorship, an LLC, a trust? What do you kind of talk to your clients about on those sort of things?
Well, the good news is that in Greenwich, we tend to get pretty sophisticated purchasers, and a lot of times they'll come in and already know exactly how they want to hold the property because they've already talked to their estate planning attorney. So, you know, if you want to use an LLC, it's usually because you're looking for some sort of limited liability against the property if something happens, like somebody slips and falls or that type of thing. With respect to it, you can have some people have family trusts and they want to put the house in the trust. And again, that's for estate planning purposes. Sometimes they just don't, you know, we've done closings for celebrities and pro athletes where they just don't want their names out in the public and they don't want people to know what they've purchased. I had one where I had the CEO of a pretty major company didn't want to affect his stock price of his company. Because if they found out he was moving to Greenwich, it could have affected the market. So in that sense, a lot of it's for privacy, a lot of it's to limit liability against someone, and a lot of it is just for estate planning purposes.
And then, because I'm sure you're a trustee on many of these documents, what does it mean for an attorney to be a trustee, and what responsibilities, if any, do you have?
It just means I get teased by my friends when they see that I've closed on a $20 million house and they want to know where the money came from. No, usually it's called a nominee trust.
Okay, cool. So that's kind of the mortgage process. We're going to come back and talk about the actual closing process when the rubber hits the road and everything has to be right for it to work out. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes here at WGCH on GreenwichStreets.com.
Balance of Nature's fruits and vegetables in a capsule, changing the world one life at a time.
I'm in the medical field, and I think when you start out these things, you know, everything from the advertisement sounds so good that you're psyched up for it to work. It's working. Anyway, I'm happy.
Balance of Nature has made a big difference. It's just one of the greatest products, and it's just so simple, and it works.
Balance of Nature is a fantastic product. You could tell it's real. You could taste it. And it gives you really good energy, and it's just right up there with rent, electric cable, like things that you have to have. I'm not cutting Balance of Nature. No, I love it.
Start your journey to better health with Balance of Nature right now. Call 1-800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com for more information or to place your order. Shipping is always free. And don't forget to get 35% off your first order as a preferred customer by using discount code Laura.
WGCH.
We're back here at Greenwich Street. So today our guest is Michael Jones from Ivy Farm and O'Mara. We've been talking about the attorney's role in a real estate transaction and all the different things that an attorney does to represent their client in a residential transaction. Let's move on for a minute, Mike, and let's talk a little bit. You know, Mark, you might want to give them a little idea of sort of the walkthrough.
Yeah, so as the agent, if we're representing the buyer, the one thing that we want to do is a walkthrough of the house to make sure that if there was an agreement that certain things should be repaired, that they actually got repaired, that the house is broom clean, and that any personal property has been removed from the house. We frequently find that sellers try to be kind and they leave old cans of paint, open bags of fertilizer, which they know the owner is going to want to use, whereas the owner just wants a clean house, or the buyer just wants a clean house. So one of the things, actually my parents, they had emptied the house, moved out, and the night before somebody broke in and started looking around, one of your more inept burglars, because you could have looked through the window and seen that there was nothing there. But so what happens when I call you up and say, by the way, the dishwasher that was supposed to be fixed hasn't been fixed. It looks like that maybe there was some water that from that last storm that they said there was never any water in the basement. How do you handle those issues?
Yeah, sure. There's generally three different ways to handle it. The first one would be depending, if it's, like you say, a dishwasher that hasn't been fixed. A lot of times the seller will just give a credit to the buyer and say, or check outside the closing, just say, here's $250 to get it fixed when you move in. The second way to do it, if the number's high enough, is sometimes we'll do an escrow and we'll put maybe, let's say it's something bigger. Let's say that the generator is gone.
Right.
When they had an inspector with them and they turned the generator on, it didn't work. Now, a new generator is $10,000 to $12,000. So at that point, you might say, well, we're going to do an escrow. We're going to put money in escrow to get it. To get it repaired.
We had just been talking about the show about how it's normally very quiet here, except when the fire trucks go by, which if you can hear, they're going by now.
Right. And the third thing that can happen is you don't close. Yeah. If it's a big enough problem, you don't close.
Yeah. And then because we've had situations where we haven't closed, and then at that point, obviously, the seller is very motivated because usually they're in their new place. And so, you know, we worked on it and come back.
Yeah.
And the deal eventually gets closed. I can only think of a couple where the buyer didn't eventually close, and in both cases, one was a financial change in the buyer's situation. He lost his job, and the other was the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Mike, talk for a second, if you would, about sort of the 5-day period that both the buyer and the seller have to delay a closing if they need to.
Yeah, so with that, actually, in a lot of the contracts now, has been extended to 10 business days, primarily because when it got so busy, the banks were taking so long to get the mortgage commitment letters out. Just generally that, at least here in Greenwich, we got together, the attorneys got together and said, you know what, we need to extend those. We expanded the 5 days to 10 days, and we expanded the 21 days on the delay of closing to 30 days. So that this way it gave the seller, the buyer more time to get their mortgage commitment, and then without having to lose the possibility of buying the house. So, but it protects the buyer in case the bank is not doing what it needs to do or moving quickly enough. And even now, with where it's gotten slower, the banks are still slow to react when it comes to getting the mortgage commitments to us. And I shouldn't really say the banks, because they tend to see generally the banks like the B of A or Bank of New York or First Republic, they'll tend to move fairly quickly. A lot of times the delay comes when you're trying to use these internet outfits like Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage. They don't move. The rockets don't move that quickly.
The rocket is not
The rocket is not. There's no liftoff. Anyway, I'll probably get sued now. But anyway,
What happens when you get past that 10-day period? Is there some penalty to one or the other?
Yeah. So sorry, Russ. Yep. Yeah. So what happens is if the delay goes longer than that, but the buyer obviously still wants to purchase the house, then you're into a situation where there's a penalty for the delay on a per diem basis, a per day basis. And there's a formula that's in the contract that it generally can come out depending on, and it's based on the purchase price. So it could be anywhere from $400 a day to $1,500 a day.
Yeah, 1/30th of 1%.
Exactly.
I've had to calculate that several times.
Yeah, sometimes it can be high.
Yeah, but just to be clear, if you have a mortgage contingency that's supposed to end on, let's say, March 30th, and the bank hasn't committed, are you saying that there is 5 or 10 days that the buyer can wait before they get that, or is that March 30th a hard date?
Well, it's what makes it not a hard date is usually the seller is willing to give them more time. It's just a question. The per diem kicks in after the 10th day.
As for the closing.
Right.
But what about on the mortgage contingency itself, which happens, you know, a couple of weeks before?
Yeah, no, the mortgage contingency date, that's sort of a hard deadline. And then it's up to the – because, you know, especially if the market is hot, there might be a backup offer.
That's where things get interesting.
Yeah, that's where it gets interesting, where there's a backup offer sitting out there, and it might be even for more money, but the sellers agreed to, you know, to stick by their bargain with the first buyer. And all of a sudden now the buyer's having trouble because they've hit the deadline on the mortgage contingency. They haven't gotten the mortgage. The seller can actually call them on the contingency and say, look, either you agree to close now without your mortgage or without the commitment and find the funds somewhere else, or we're moving on to the next buyer. And the next buyer might be a cash deal.
Yeah, and particularly if you have a long closing. I mean, the market may have actually improved since then. You know, at one point we were going up over 1% a month. So, you know, 60 days later, the house was worth 2% more.
Let's move on for a second. Let's talk about the title insurance, Mike, and sort of what's title insurance all about.
Yeah, so the funny thing is the first thing that I hear from a sophisticated buyer, or maybe they're not so sophisticated, is they'll say, well, title insurance is just a scam. It's just a gimmick. So once again, I put my litigation hat on, and then I tell my client, well, guess what? Right now in the office, I have 25 litigation matters defending title claims, and the title insurance company is paying to me to defend those claims on behalf of the buyers. And what that usually means is that title insurance is insurance that you can purchase. It's a one-time purchase when you buy your house. It's not something where you pay a premium every year. You pay the premium at the closing and you're done as far as the premium goes. But what it does is it protects you in case there's some sort of claim that's made against your property which affects your title. So, and what classic example is adverse possession. Buyer moves into the house, they have a survey done, and they find out that the next door neighbor's property actually encroaches over onto your property, or their fence encroaches over onto your property by 5 or 10 feet. And now the neighbor is coming over and smiling and saying, hey, guess what? I own that 5 to 10 feet by 20 feet. And that's called, and they claim it by what's called adverse possession. And then the neighbor sues you to try to glom on to that piece of property. And so who's going to defend you? Well, your title insurance company is going to come in, pay for someone like myself to defend you on that claim so that you don't have attorney's fees to defend the adverse – they have to pay attorney's fees to defend the adverse possession claim. So despite some of the consensus out there that it's a scam, it's not a scam. It's something that is definitely necessary because you never know what's going to come up. The classic example that people use all the time is the old Indian claims. So back in the day when Mohegan Sun wanted to come into existence, they were threatening basically to exert all these – or assert all these Indian land claims up in that area against hundreds and hundreds of homeowners. And that's where the title companies would have had to, again, come in and defend it.
Yeah. So, and then, I've been an expert witness in several title insurance claims. One of them that was interesting was there was a long drive, muddy driveway from one of our major streets into this house. But it also bordered a beautiful private road with much higher end houses. And so they were going to come in that way. And it turned out they actually didn't have that easement, and the mm-hmm. title insurance company had insured it. And so one of the questions was, how much difference in value was there for the house, whether they came in and the title insurance company took care of all that. The interesting thing is the title insurance is unlike normal insurance when you buy something. If you buy it today and you had an accident, you know, 3 months ago, you're not covered. But with title insurance, it looks back and not forward. So errors in chains of title, prescriptive easements of people walking across your land and stuff like that. Do you guys see that very much where somebody said, well, you know, I've always walked down to the pond across this part of the property?
Yeah, you do see it. You see it also. There'll be claims with respect to rights of way and just general easements that people have. What we see often is someone will have an easement across someone else's property, and the person, they call them the subservient landowner, the person that owns the property that you have the right of way over, that person all of a sudden plants a tree in the middle of the right of way or puts up a fence and prevents you from continuing to walk down the right of way that you actually have the right to walk across to get to, say, the beach. Yeah. And then there'll be an insurance, title insurance claim.
Okay. I saw something just this weekend, if I can jump in, as I was doing a drive in northern Stanford. All of a sudden these fences were very carefully built along a driveway that was going down past some property down behind. And I thought, interesting, very close to two fences, perfectly the same, following this driveway. I was wondering, well, who put that up? It must have been the one that was getting the easement, right?
Yeah, that could be a situation too where whoever put the fence up first didn't paint the back side of it. So there's probably a dispute going on. So the other people figured, you know, we'll put our own fence up so we can look at something that's nicer than the back of a bad looking fence.
Luckily, we don't see that very often. Okay, so now I've done the walkthrough with the client, and it looks like everything's okay. The house is broom clean. The personal property's been removed. They've mowed the grass. What happens from that point? Let's say you're representing the buyer. As to what should the buyer expect from now until the time they get the keys?
Yeah. So once all contingencies are lifted, and if the seller has any work that has to be done, if that's all done, the attorneys have scheduled the closing. Now, the big difference over the past couple of years because of COVID is that back before COVID, the lawyers actually got together face to face, often with not so much the sellers. Sellers, for the most part, have stopped.
It's been a while since
I haven't seen a seller at a closing in a long time.
Back when I did it, it was great because everybody was there and it was usually pretty happy.
It was like a big – well, usually, yeah. It was a big party. But no, the sellers stopped coming about 6 or 7 years ago, and because they don't really – the seller doesn't have to sign anything at a closing. So it got to the point where – and a lot of times people didn't want the sellers at the closing because, like you said earlier, sellers are trying to be nice and they start talking about something that they did to the property, and all of a sudden they've jackpotted themselves into a problem at the closing. You know, so sellers stopped coming a while ago, but the buyers, you'd still see the buyers at the closings, and the lawyers would all be there. Depending on how much work had been done by the lawyers before the closing to get prepared and get ready, usually the closings didn't take too long. Nowadays, post COVID, we really rarely even get together. What happens is everything is sort of worked out between the lawyers over the phone or on a Zoom call or by email. And then once we know that we have the funds, we'll tell this, like if we're the buyer, we'll tell the seller's attorney we now have the funds. Seller's attorney will have already sent all the closing sale documents like the deed and some of the other, the 1099, the FRPTA, other forms over to us. We would have already, the buyer's counsel, agreed with all the paperwork. And then it's just a question of we notify them that we have our money. They notify us they're ready to go. They send us documents. We send them funds. And a lot of the closings now are just virtual. We don't even really – or maybe you'll drop off the documents to the other lawyer. But you don't really see too many people anymore. If the buyer's got a mortgage, you've got to meet with the buyer to have the mortgage papers signed that morning. But even then, the buyers come in. They sign the mortgage papers. And they head out to get ready to talk to the to meet up with the mover to be ready to go over to the house. So you don't have the traditional closings that you used to have post-COVID.
One of my more interesting closings was over at Ivy Barnum O'Mara in the early days of COVID when everybody was being very careful and my clients did need a mortgage. And I always go with my clients to the closing just in case there's an issue. and it was being done on a picnic table on the sidewalk outside. And it was a cool day. It was probably like 45 degrees or so. Poor old Elaine, the biggest problem was the documents kept blowing away.
Yeah, so we actually put the two it's funny because COVID, we were busier than we had ever been in our lives.
All-time record year for sales.
Record year for sales. But again, we couldn't have people in the building. So we literally put we had two picnic tables at the time outside in the back parking lot, and they were used nonstop as people were coming for the closings, and it was even in cold weather. But then during the summer, it was pretty nice because it was warm out. So we've left one of the picnic tables there, and we still do closings outside. So.
I did another closing where the attorney worked from home, and she had a bay window, and there were two windows, and she would crack them about an inch, and she would slide the document out, and you had a little table, and you would sign it, and then you would slide it back. Nowadays, so what is the kind of, have you had any legal issues with electronic signatures and those things, or pretty much everybody accepting those?
Well, everybody but town hall. So you can do DocuSign on the contracts, right? So you don't, or you can even have your clients sign and scan an email. But when it comes to recording, which the buyer's attorney has to record the deed and record the mortgage and any other documents, a couple other documents from the closing, those have to have wet signatures. Mm-hmm. So the sellers still have to wet sign like the deed and a couple of the other sale documents.
Yeah, and you're saying a lot of the mortgage companies want wet signatures.
Yeah, they
too?
Still want wet signatures too in town hall. Yeah.
So the any other issues that arise at closing that we haven't talked about in the way of as you mentioned the buyer who wasn't the buyer.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Again, I've only seen that once in my life, so that was sort of interesting. I've had refinances where we're refinancing a mortgage, and I've had a couple where I had one in particular with a top 100, the CEO of a top 100 company, and his wife was signing everything, and she realized for the first time that she was not on the title to the house in Nantucket, and we stopped the closing and came back about 6 hours later, and guess what? She was now on the title to the house in Nantucket. I've seen some odd things when it comes to more with refinances than closings themselves.
I had a closing in Belhaven where very nice woman who came from a lot of money, and she married the tennis pro. And it quickly turned out that he was spending time with other women, and I think the marriage lasted about a year and a half. They had a house in Belhaven, and they went to and the buyers were this beautiful couple from Alabama, both very good looking, three great little girls, and the tennis pro refused to sign. He wanted more money. He wanted a bigger percentage. So anyway, we recessed the closing. Everybody went to lunch. I read the guy the riot act as to what we were going to do when we came back, and he had signed and actually left by the time people came back. Anyway, that's it for Greenwich Streets here on WGCH. You can see it on greenwichstreets.com on our podcast and here on WGCH. We want to thank Mike Jones for coming in, and we look forward to seeing you next Monday. Have a good day. Good day.
This is your community radio station serving